Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Climate change, science, and politics. Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Another alarm about global warming came with last week's report that glaciers in Greenland are melting faster than ever. Skeptics already are raising questions, adding that air and water pollution are much more immediate threats than rising sea levels. On To the Point, we'll hear the latest dispute about the impact of climate change. Some scientists claim the Earth is reaching a tipping point, beyond which no conceivable effort will make a difference. Others say human beings will adapt to whatever happens. In the meantime, why not launch a satellite that could clear up some of the scientific uncertainties? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the troubles at the Winter Olympics. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Greenland's glaciers are melting faster than ever. Will rising sea levels be a threat to human habitation? On To the Point, we'll hear the latest dispute about global warming. Would a satellite canceled by the Bush administration clear up some of the scientific uncertainties? On Reporter's Notebook, Pratt Falls, quarreling teammates, and a doping scandal. We'll hear about the Winter Olympics. First, this news update. Yesterday, Israel froze $50 million a month in tax and customs receipts due to the Palestinian Authority. Today, Hamas, which took over the Palestinian parliament on Saturday, says it has other ways to get the money. Stephen Erlanger reports from Jerusalem for the New York Times. Steve, good to have you back with us.
Hello.
Is it possible that the Palestinian Authority can get the money it needs to pay tens of thousands of workers in time before they have to be laid off?
Well, it's always possible, but it's going to be very, very difficult. I mean, they currently, even before the Hamas victory, were running a budget deficit of about $60 million a month with the Israeli decision to keep back customs and tax receipts and put them into escrow. They will need to find about $110 million a month, which is $1.1 billion a year, just to keep going. Now, they currently employ about 140,000 people who are the breadwinners for about a third of the population, and that includes school teachers and hospital workers, but nearly half of them, 58,000 of them, are armed security people in some fashion or another. So to some degree, the Palestinian Authority is a kind of, you know, welfare agency for employment in a bad economic time. And I think it is going to be very difficult for them to find that much money. Not only find it, but bring it into the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinians pay in Israeli shekels. And if Israel wants to try to keep out money from Iran, say, to the Palestinian Authority, they probably have the banking controls to do it. And to smuggle in that much cash every month would be almost an impossible thing to do.
Talk to Stephen Erlanger with the New York Times in Jerusalem. Are most of those armed security forces members of Fatah and hence opposed to Hamas, or are they split in some way? How do they shake down?
Well, one of the things that, you know, the Americans wanted the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, to do was to consolidate these forces. There are at least 12 different Palestinian security forces, and part of the plan was to get them down to 3. But this number also includes people who were recently put on the payroll, put on in the last year, as part of a plan to soak up a lot of the armed young men who were roaming around the streets of the city, who had been to some degree sponsored by the Intifada, by the uprising, who had looked to Yasser Arafat as their father, and who were loosely affiliated with Fatah. Some of them were with the so-called Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which was Fatah's military wing. But with the death of Arafat, about 14 months ago, All this began to fall apart, and these martyrs' brigades became localized, atomized, and it's very hard to say they're under anybody's control. But the idea was to get them off the streets and try to put them into the security forces and give them a salary, and that was a strategy that the West supported. The problem now is the Palestinian Authority is going to have trouble with money. So generally, they do support Fatah. They're not Hamas people, but basically they'll support whoever can pay them.
All right. So Hamas could be in trouble if it can't pay them, with those people roaming around in the streets, presumably. In the meantime, I understand that today Hamas is beginning to form up its cabinet. Ismail Haniyeh is thought to be is already chosen as the prime minister. Europe and the United States urged Israel to see what kind of a cabinet might form up before it decided to make the decision it already has. What is the cabinet apparently going to look like?
Well, Haniyeh is one of the two main Hamas leaders inside the territories. He's in Gaza. He's about 42 years old. And he is trying to pull together a broad-range government that would include other parties and factions. So far, the leftist Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has agreed to go in with him. He would like to have a lot of Fatah members come into the cabinet. So far, Fatah officially has said it doesn't want any part of this. But there were a number of Fatah members who sort of left the party for the election, who ran as independents and who won with Hamas's support. And some of them are likely to join the cabinet, people like Ziad Abu Amr, who's another Gazan, who is a PhD from the University of Chicago, and who may end up being foreign minister. So Hamas wants a broad-range government, but Hamas will run it.
All right. We will see how that government shapes up as the days go by. Meantime, Steve Erlanger with the New York Times in Jerusalem. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, the science and politics of climate change on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. The glaciers of southern Greenland are dumping twice as much ice into the Atlantic Ocean as they were 5 years ago, because of global warming. That's from a report published last week in Science, the Journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. One of the co-authors is Dr. Eric Rigneault from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California. Dr. Rigneault, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Are you alarmed by this finding?
I think we're not really alarmed, but we were very surprised to see the magnitude of the glacier changes and how widespread these changes were.
Surprised. What are the consequences or possible consequences?
Well, one major consequence is that this is calling into question predictions of the future of the Greenland ice sheet in a warmer climate, because models used to do these predictions currently do not include the possibility of changes in glacier flow. And what we're seeing right now in Greenland suggests that not only this is an important factor, this actually may be driving the whole system in a warmer climate.
By whole system, what do you mean? Worldwide?
I mean by driving the evolution of the Greenland ice sheet in a warmer climate. The response of the glaciers to the climate change will be extremely important in determining how fast ice will be removed on the ice sheet.
Now, the Greenland ice sheet, as I understand it, is somewhat comparable to the Gulf of Mexico, the water in the Gulf of Mexico being frozen and stuck down on top of that island up there. Is that about right?
I don't have the exact magnitudes in hand. This the equivalent of 7 meters of global sea level change stored in the Greenland ice sheet.
So we're talking about a lot of potential water if, in fact, it begins to melt. Now, when you say that it appears to be melting faster than had been thought and that will change predictions about the fate of the ice sheet. What does that mean in terms of ocean levels?
Well, this probably means that predictions that have been published, for instance, by the IPCC reports, which suggest a change in sea level of 7 to 9 centimeters over the next century, probably need to be revised upwards because the contribution from the polar ice sheets, and in particular Greenland, are likely to be higher.
Now, does this suggest that the same thing is happening in other parts of the world, in the Arctic and Antarctica, as well as in Greenland?
Well, we know already that parts of the Antarctic ice sheet are changing, especially the northern part, the Antarctic Peninsula, where climate warming is actually proceeding at six times the global average, and the glacier changes there, I would call, more dramatic than in Greenland.
So if they're more dramatic, then what is your concern at this point about how fast the ice is melting and how quickly the oceans are likely to rise?
Well, it's difficult for me to predict how fast sea level is going to rise. What we can say, however, is that it is quite possible that the wave of acceleration is going to propagate further north in Greenland as climate warming proceeds further north along the coast, and this could easily double the mass loss of Greenland in the very near future.
So would this then be likely to produce changes around the world that would have an impact on human civilization?
That's very difficult to say. I think that the amount of fresh water that is being added to the ocean right now as a result of the melting of the ice sheet is not an immediate concern for ocean circulation, but it's going in a direction of a possible influence on ocean circulation.
Again, Dr. Eric Rigneault is research scientist for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, part of NASA in Southern California. Dr. John Christie is professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth System Science Center at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. And Dr. Christie, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
What's your reaction to Dr. Rigneault's findings?
Well, I think it's a very clever study using satellites that to determine the ice flow rates and how they've changed over the past 13 years. And so my hat is off for this kind of study. It's really remarkable. But I would like your listeners to take a mental look at how the temperatures have changed in Greenland over the last 80 years. And that gives a different perspective on what's going on, perhaps. If you look at the time series of the way the temperature has changed in that part of Greenland, you will see a very warm period back in the late 20s and 30s and a declining temperature to about 1990, 1991, and then a rise from that point, which is still not as warm as it was back in the 20s and 30s. And so, unfortunately, this study, the satellites we have for this study, begin right about the time that Greenland was its coldest point in the last 80 years. And one wonders if part of what we're seeing here is simply the warming of the last 15. That is pretty clear. I mean, the temperature has risen there in the last 15 years. And so short of a shorter-term scale is what we're seeing here. And I would like to remind the listeners also that there are other studies that show the Greenland ice cap is actually accumulating ice and snow from different perspectives. So it is a complicated problem, and more data, more years of study are needed to really nail down what's happening with the ice mass balance there.
Dr. Rigneault, back to you. What about these other studies and about the point that the temperatures in Greenland have apparently only been rising in the past 15 years, that it was in fact warmer than that in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I agree with Dr. Christie. If you look at the temperature record from Greenland, there was a warm period in the 1920s, which lasted about 10 years, and probably had an influence on the glaciers then. Unfortunately, we don't have good data on that time period on the evolution of the glaciers. I think the main difference between that transition and what we're seeing today is that we don't see the end of this warming period today, and we are at the point, if climate warming continues to warm the way it does around Greenland, to go into a period that has been unprecedented in this century. So, in terms of how warm things are getting. Now, on the other point about the increase in snow accumulation in the interior, again, I agree with him, and I'm aware of his studies that showed a growth of the ice sheet in the interior, and this is indeed something we also expect from climate warming, to have more precipitation, more snowfall in the interior. We did account for that in our study, although we did not treat that aspect directly. We used published results on that. However, what we found out is that this effect is a secondary effect on the overall evolution of total ice mass in Greenland. So that the main effect remains the change in flow of the glaciers on top of the increase in melt and the snow accumulation, which goes the other way.
Dr. Christie, what about the statement that it appears that we don't see the end of the warming and that this may be unprecedented in this century? If that's true, what would the consequences be?
Well, in terms of sea level rise, I think that's what everything boils down to, is what is happening to sea level. And right now, the sea level is rising almost an inch per decade. As a state climatologist of Alabama, I like to point out to people that it's not the inch per decade that's going to be the problem. It is the 15 feet or 20 feet that comes in with a hurricane. And that's why I advise against building right along the coast. But it's important to remember that in past periods like this that were warm, say 130,000 years ago, the sea level was about 18, 20 feet higher than it is now. And I think the best guess is that Greenland was much smaller at that time. And so until we get to the next ice age, I think we will see continued rise at sea level. Whether you want to blame it on humans adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere or not, that we should expect sea level to rise and be prepared and adapt to that.
So sea level will rise. How fast will it rise? Will we be able to adapt to it, particularly in places like Bangladesh?
I'll try to answer that a bit.
Sure, thank you.
The sea level rise of an inch per decade that looks like will probably occur in the next century will mean that people will have to adapt, and I think we see from the history of time that people do that. I don't think they're the kind that just come to the edge of a cliff, and when other people are going off, they go on too. They see what is happening and move inland or do something accordingly to take care of that and protect themselves.
Do you think there's any way that we could, on a worldwide basis, stop the climate change that's taking place? Dr. Christie.
My view is no, in this sense, that as long as energy is being primarily produced from the burning of carbon, that will continue at least for a few decades, because energy means a better life and higher standard of living for everyone. And that is what people want, and so that's a very difficult thing to try to extract from people is a promise to lower their standard of living.
There's a recent poll that shows 2 out of 3 of the people in India, which is of course an undeveloped nation under the Kyoto Protocol and doesn't have to do anything about global warming, but 2 out of 3 people that were polled there said that they would be eager to see India try to bring greenhouse gas emissions under control. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me at all, but when you go to India, and I've been there, and tell them that they will not have energy to light their ovens or to turn on the switch to light their homes, they have a different view. Now, I think that in 100 years, we won't have energy from carbon as we do today, that there will be other sources, and this issue will slowly just fade away because of the ingenuity of people and the need, I think, and the desire to have different sources of energy that don't burn carbon.
Dr. John Christie, again, the state climatologist of the state of Alabama and professor of atmospheric science, director of the Earth System Science Center at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Professor Tom Burke is visiting professor at Imperial College London. He also is a former environmental advisor to the British government. Professor Burke, welcome to you.
Good evening. Good morning, but it's evening here.
It is different times at different places where this program is heard. So whatever you say will be adequate. And thank you very much for being so thoughtful about our listeners. You've been quoted as saying that we have already reached a tipping point beyond which we're not going to be able to have an impact on changing temperatures. How do you get to that conclusion?
Well, first of all, I haven't said we've gone past the point at which we can have an impact. I actually disagree quite strongly with what John Christie said, that this is a choice between having a stable climate or having a lower standard of living. We have the technology we need now to use fossil fuels, but to use them in a way which does not continue the destabilization of the climate. We're just not prepared to spend the money to deploy those technologies. What I said was that we may very well have passed, and this is reading the reports of the coming through in the peer-reviewed science, that we may already have passed the point at which we can keep temperatures below the 2 degrees centigrade that the European nations, ministers and leaders of the European countries have said is the borderline for dangerous climate change, so that we may already have passed that point. Of course, having passed that point doesn't mean that it can't get more dangerous, and therefore there aren't still things that we can usefully do to reduce the impacts of a changing climate on human well-being.
What would dangerous climate change mean?
It would mean a lot of different things. It would mean changes, and we've already heard some of them, in sea level rise. It would mean changes in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events. That translates into drought and floods, for instance, more of the kind of events we've just seen in the Philippines, if you like, periods of prolonged rain in local areas and unusual levels of rain, or the kind of things you saw very graphically in the United States last year with Katrina. We'd see more of those kind of events. We'd see changes in the way disease vectors spread. We'd see changes in the distribution of animals and plants. We would increasingly look likely that we would begin to see a loss of agricultural productivity in many places. So we'd see a huge range of both geophysical and ecological effects, not very many of which would be adding up to good things for human beings.
What would it cost to use the technologies that you described to slow this process?
A lot less than it's cost to go to war in Iraq. Probably we're going to spend about $17 trillion meeting the world's need for energy, and I agree with John Christie that we've got to go on doing that. We're going to spend those $17 trillion anyway between now and 2030. To change that technology trajectory might cost an extra 10 to 15%, i.e., over the whole of that period, maybe less than we've already spent on the Iraq war.
So, in other words, then, you think it would be affordable if we chose to do it?
Yes. The two things that we're really short of in this area are, first of all, time, because while we talk and debate the issue, events are determining the outcomes for us. And the second thing that we're short of is political will. We're not short of technology. We're not short of economic resources.
Again, Professor Tom Burke is visiting at the Imperial College London, former environmental advisor to the British government. We're going to take a break and continue this conversation with Professor Burke. Thanks very much to Dr. John Christie and Dr. Eric Garino for being on the first part of our program. On Reporter's Notebook later, the troubles at the Winter Olympics. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. Started our program today with the fact that the glaciers of southern Greenland are dumping twice as much ice into the Atlantic Ocean as they were 5 years ago, melting faster than had been thought. Still some dispute as to how long the warming trend has been going on. But we just heard from Professor Tom Burke, a visiting professor at Imperial College London, a former environmental advisor to the British government, that we have the technology to slow the impact of climate change without changing or without sacrificing the lifestyle that people all over the world want and demand. If we spend something like 10 to 15% more on energy than we're going to spend anyway. Professor Burke, is that an adequate paraphrase of what you said?
That's a very fair paraphrase. Yes, indeed, Warren.
Okay. Let me move to our next guest, Myron Ebell, Director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. That's a center that advocates free enterprise and limited government. Myron Ebell, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What do you say to what we just heard from Professor Burke, that the climate is changing and that we could retard it successfully by spending only 10 or 15% more than we are anyway for energy?
Well, we get 85% of our energy worldwide from fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. And the projections for the future by the International Energy Agency in Paris are that in 20 years we'll get a slightly higher percentage from coal, oil, and natural gas. And when you say only 10 to 15%, if you look at 2 billion people in the world who do not have access to the benefits of modern industrial civilization because they're not hooked up to the electricity grid, if you're saying 10 or 15%, you're essentially consigning 10 or 15% of those people who would otherwise be hooked up to the electricity grid in the next 20 years not to being hooked up. And so this is, a real issue of equity. We could obviously become 10 or 15% poorer in terms of our energy use in this country, and it wouldn't be all that bad for a lot of people, but it would be very bad for a lot of people, of course, who, for example, have a hard time heating their homes in the winter. A lot more people, of course, die from cold than die from warm. I think it's very easy to juggle these figures around. When the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated in 1997, there were studies commissioned from econometric forecasting firms that said the price of gasoline may have to go up by 75 cents a gallon in order to meet the targets. And that estimate was widely debunked by environmental groups who said, oh, that's ridiculous. These people are crying wolf. It won't cost nearly that much. Well, since 1997, the price of gasoline in the United States has gone up a lot more than 75 cents a gallon, and yet consumption has not gone down. It's gone up. So I think actually it will cost a lot more than 10 or 15% extra in our energy bills. And I think you see that in Europe, where you have several dollars a gallon tacked on in taxes to the price of gasoline, and yet consumption is continuing to go up, even though people are being forced into smaller and smaller cars. So I just don't, I really doubt that this rosy picture of how easy it will be is really true.
What then about the consequences of global warming? Do we just have to live with them?
Well, I think we have to deal with environmental change all the time. And, of course, I think cooling is a lot more serious a threat than warming, because most of our food is grown in the temperate zone where all the land is. A little bit of cooling in the Little Ice Age caused essentially European civilization to be under stress for several centuries with continued threats of crop failure. So I think we do have to deal with change, and I think that it's very easy to kind of throw all these things together and say this makes a disaster. But in fact, I think if you look at each one of the things that Mr. Burke brought up, you'll see that it's either exaggerated or false, or the timescales are all wrong. Sea level rise at the current rate, or even at an accelerated rate, people don't just stand where they are on the edge of the beach and wait 100 years before their knees are covered up. They would move back a few inches. We've been dealing with sea level rise since the end of the last ice age. A primitive man dealt with it as well. And, you know, for example, Holland became one of the richest countries in the world at the same time it was reclaiming the salt marshes using pre-modern technology. So the seas are going to keep rising until the next ice age starts at one rate or another. It may increase a little bit. It may go down a little bit. Who knows? But this idea that Greenland is suddenly going to melt in a few years, or as some people in Britain have said, in 20 feet the sea levels are going to rise, London will disappear. Well, that's not a century. That's probably 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years. We may well be in the next ice age within that period. And that's a real problem. I think that, whoever is alive then, whatever civilization we have, no matter how advanced it is going to have a huge problem with the next ice age. But that's not something you can plan for.
Myron Ebell, let me ask you a question, if I may. You're director of Global Warming and International Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Last time you were on our program, I got emails from listeners who wanted me to ask this question, which is one of the reasons I'm putting it to you. Is your work supported by corporations that have a stake in the outcome of this debate?
Yes, the Competitive Enterprise Institute has an annual budget of a little over $3 million, and typically About a third of that comes from corporations, a third of it from individual donors, and a third of it from foundations. And some of that $1 million or so that comes from corporations comes from various types of energy companies. However, you know, I find this I don't mind having my motives questioned, but I always find it odd that other people's motives aren't questioned. For example, Mr. Correll, who was on 60 Minutes the other night and described as one of the world's foremost authorities on climate change, even though, as far as I can tell, he's not a climate scientist and doesn't actually publish in climate science. It works for a consulting firm that stands to gain large amounts of money in helping corporations defend themselves against lawsuits and that kind of thing.
So, I understand the point. Mr. Correll's not on our program. Professor Tom Burke is. Let me go back to him in London. And Mr. Burke, earlier Myron Ebell said he thought that the comments you'd made were exaggerated and false, and that the timescales you were using were wrong. Do you work for anybody who stands to gain from the outcome of this debate?
Yes, of course I do. I work for a large mining company, which stands to gain from the outcome of this debate, but it stands to gain from the outcome of this debate by having a stable climate in which it continues to be able to make long-run investments with some idea of the kind of risk it's putting its shareholders' money to. I agree with Myron about this, that I'm not that bothered about questioning people's motives in this debate. I think that doesn't get us very far. Let's address the arguments as they're put by people. I didn't actually put any arguments about timescales, so I was kind of interested in Myron attacking me for a position I didn't hold. And I was interested in both him and John Christie taking the what we might call the let-them-eat-cake approach to adaptation to a changing climate. You know, it's all very well to talk about people stepping back from the shore and not waiting till the water gets up to their knees. The problem is, in many parts of the world, the people behind the people on the shore are not going to be too keen about the people on the shore stepping back. It's kind of simplistic way to talk about it. The fact of the matter is that adaptation to climate change isn't just a matter of erecting physical barriers or making physical changes. It means making major changes in the way in which property is distributed. Now, working for the Competitiveness Enterprise Institute, Myron Ebell will have a very good idea of just how difficult it is to start reallocating property rights as climate change forces agricultural zones or forest zones or urban areas to move away from the coast. It isn't going to be that simple.
So what about it, Myron Ebell? And once again, I asked the question about support for research primarily because my listeners wanted me to. What do you say to what we just heard from Tom Burke? Pretty expensive either way you look at it.
Well, actually, I think that it's pretty clear if you add up the figures that have been put out by places like the UN Environment Program that the costs of dealing with climate change will be much lower than the attempt, the roundabout attempt to which is probably doomed to fail, to stop climate change in its tracks. The kinds of estimates that have been given for the total damages of all of these alleged impacts, many of which I think are, again, exaggerated or false or in the wrong time scale, is about $300 billion a year globally. And I think that's from the UN Environment Program. And I think that you'll see that we couldn't possibly begin to implement the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty worldwide for probably three or four times that amount of money. And Kyoto is only the first step. Remember, if you start cutting emissions and a company has to react by limiting its energy use in some way or finding new, more expensive energy sources, it's going to do the cheapest things first. And so everybody who's trying to implement Kyoto is doing the cheapest things first. In the next round, beyond 2012, when Kyoto expires, if there were a new agreement, they would have to start doing the slightly more expensive things next, and then in a third round and so on. So each round they'll be doing more expensive things. So this will very quickly become a very expensive proposition.
Okay. Obviously, a great room for a disagreement on this issue. And I apologize, Myron Ebell, for cutting you off. But I want to introduce another guest with another thing to argue about in this discussion. Professor Bob Park is professor of physics, former chair of the Department of Physics at the University of Maryland, writes a weblog that has his own ideas and his only, not the University of Maryland's. It's called What's New. It's at www.bobpark.org. And, Professor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Surely.
You wrote recently about the satellite Triana, which was scheduled to be launched by the United States. It was originally the idea of Vice President Al Gore. It's now been canceled by the Bush administration. If that were launched, to what extent would it provide hard scientific evidence that might help to resolve the disputes about global warming?
I think it would have gone a long way to doing exactly that. It should have been launched in 2001. In fact, it should have been launched in 2000, but we had an accident with a shuttle. In any case, it's been paid for. It's sitting there, but they're now dismantling it because the project has been terminated, I think just because it's got Al Gore's initials on it. But it's not really Al Gore's idea. It's an idea that he has adopted, and I think it was a good one. In fact, listening to this debate, what I've enjoyed about it is the fact that we have two sides here who are convinced they are right, and the result of that has been very good for the public. Both sides are determined to get better evidence to show that they're right.
Well, how would this satellite give them that better evidence?
This satellite, it would be at the so-called Lagrange 1 point, which is between the Earth and the Sun, and it can look in one direction and see the Sun, look in the opposite direction and see the full Earth, the entire disk of the Earth. As a result, they can measure the amount of energy coming from the Sun and measure the amount of energy coming back from the Earth, and they know exactly then what the energy balance is. That's always been one of the big issues in the whole climate debate, is what is the albedo of the Earth, and is the Earth continuing to get warmer or not? We can find out. We could have found out by now.
Is it getting warmer, or are the changes we see the result of warmth, greater warmth in the sun? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's been one of the big questions.
Okay.
Many of the global warming deniers have insisted that, look, none of this has anything to do with what we humans are doing. It really has to do with the variations in solar radiance. And we can answer that question in a very straightforward way and at a very modest cost. It's been killed for entirely political reasons.
All right. Professor Bob Park, formerly at the University of Maryland. Back to Myron Ebell at the Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise, head of Environmental Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. What do you say to that? Would that provide information that would help to better delineate these controversies?
Well, I think basically anything that will add to our understanding of this is a good thing. I think I don't know all the details of this, and I don't know how much it would, you know, new questions arise. You know, Dr. Christie, who you had on earlier, is one of the people who has done the satellite readings for temperatures in the lower troposphere, and they don't quite match those on the surface, and that of course gives rise to new questions. So, but I think it sounds great, and I'm all for it if it would help us resolve some of these questions. I look forward to resolving some of them and getting on to working on more serious issues.
Let me go back to Professor Burke at Imperial College London. What do you say to this? Ought we to launch this satellite and find out at least part of the science once and for all?
We certainly should do that, but actually, the idea that there is a great debate amongst the scientists about many of these issues is an artifact of the media. The fact of the matter is that the debate, for instance, that Myron Ebell just referred to with John Christie has been pretty comprehensively sorted out in the peer-reviewed science journals, and sorted out why there was this apparent difference between the higher and lower readings. And so to go on referring to a debate that actually amongst the scientists was settled some time ago is slightly odd. But certainly I agree with him and your other guest, Bob, that to launch a satellite would be a very good thing. It would help us add more information, and the more information we have, the more we're likely to make better decisions.
Well, if the debate, though, is an artifact of the media, do you think it would continue regardless of whatever new information the Triana satellite might provide?
I think the governments, apart from the current administration in the U.S., have broadly made up their minds on the science of climate change already. I think the debate that has to continue is a very important debate about what is the best way to provide climate security for the 6.5 billion people on the planet, including the 2 billion people, by the way, that Myron referred to, and I share his concern about, who don't have access to electricity. I want them to have access to electricity, but I also want them to have a stable climate so that they can enjoy that access.
So, Myron Ebell, do you then concede that global warming is, in fact, going on, and is the debate really about what to do?
Well, I certainly think global warming is happening in a mild way, and I certainly think human beings have something to do with it. I think a lot of the debate is continually foreshortened to exclude natural variability, which we have to deal with whether human beings are involved or not. I mean, this question about there could be bigger droughts. Well, the biggest drought in the 20th century was in the North America, was in the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma area. It was much more intense than anything we've had since then, but it was quite small compared to droughts that are historically documented and archaeologically documented in, for instance, the American Southwest in the 13th and 14th centuries.
So let me go back to Bob Park. The satellite, then, wouldn't obviously provide information about history, would it?
No, it really wouldn't. It'll tell you what's happening right now, and if you measure that over a period of time, it'll tell you what trend we're facing right now. But it really addresses this question of whether solar radiation is a major factor here.
Well, would it resolve the dispute between Myron Ebell, who says there is global warming in a mild way, and Professor Burke, who says it's global warming is happening fast and it's very serious?
Well, I think I agree with Professor Burke that the jury is pretty much in on that one. It's there and it's serious, and we humans are a large part of it.
Okay.
There's no doubt about that.
All right. Once again, thank you all very much for being with us. Professor Bob Park, University of Maryland, still at the University of Maryland, didn't mean to remove you from there, but former chair of the Department of Physics. Myron Ebell with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Professor Tom Burke visiting at Imperial College London, and our earlier guests, John Christie, professor at the University of Alabama, and Dr. Eric Rignot at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California. The Winter Olympics in Italy have featured spectacular falls on the ice, icy relations between American skaters, and the first Olympic doping raid involving local police. But still, NBC's ratings are lousy. More from Turin in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Front pages of the world's newspapers today ran multiple pictures of normally graceful figure skaters sprawled all over the ice at the Winter Olympics. Last night, Walter Mayer, the Austrian coach at the center of a doping investigation, crashed his car into a police barricade after a chase across the Italian border. Alan Abramson is in Turin trying to keep track of it all for the Los Angeles Times. And Alan, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Good. Short time to cover a lot of stuff. But what about Walter Mayer and the Austrian team? This is the first time that local police have been brought into an investigation like this. How serious does it appear to be?
Well, we're not really sure yet how serious it appears to be. What is abundantly clear is that the ground rules have changed, that when you bring the police in to raid the athletes' quarters at the games, they did not go into the village.
Mm-hmm.
But they went into some rented apartments that the Austrian biathlon and cross-country teams had rented up in the mountains. That sort of signals a big change afoot. It's one thing to get busted for doping, and by the way, let's say no one's been busted here on the Austrian team for anything. In the abstract, it's one thing to be busted for doping and be banned from swimming or running or skiing for 2 years. It's another to think that you might go to jail for 2 years, and that's the prospect here in Italy, which has criminalized doping.
Last time we talked about this in the aftermath of the last Olympic Games, you said it appeared that the Olympic Committee is getting very serious. I gather this is evidence that it is.
Yeah, I think what you see here are the logical follow-on consequences of what happens when you get governments and sports authorities together. If everyone remembers, there was a big scandal in 1998 at the Tour de France, and that sparked the formation of the World Anti-Doping Agency. And now, 8 years later, 7 years later, you see that agency sort of really coming into its own. The IOC is actually doing the test here, but believe me, WADA is monitoring. You see things like Hermann Mayer, the Alpine star, who's not related to Walter Mayer in any way. He was approached February 9th by doping control officers posing as fans. And the authorities are trying all sorts of innovative and aggressive methods to try and ferret out doping.
Okay, we will follow that situation, of course, as it goes on. Meantime, what about the arguments about members of the American team, particularly involving Shani Davis?
Well, I think what you have here is a rivalry, plain and simple. You have a rivalry, and you've got a rivalry between some amazingly compelling personalities. Shani Davis is the world record holder in the 1,000 meters in speed skating, which is, except for the Winter Olympics, a niche sport. I mean, the nichiest of niche sports, right? And Chad Hedrick is a former inline skater who won 50 world titles and decided to switch over to the ice and won the 5,000 meters here on the game's first day of competition. So you got two guys going at it, and they both wear red, white, and blue. And they're both complicated personalities, and the situation is exacerbated by the fact that Shani Davis has always trained alone and apart from the U.S. Speed Skating Federation for reasons of his own choosing and because the Speed Skating Federation really does not do enough to support any of these athletes.
Well, now, he declined to participate in a team event. Some of the other Americans, Chad Hedrick, I gather, prominent among them. You talked about the compelling personalities involved. Those seem to be the most compelling. Said that he thought that hurt the chances of the team. What about that? And to what extent is there a team psychology there? To what extent is it every athlete for himself?
Well, I think Chad Hedrick is absolutely right, but the question is, so what? I mean, it absolutely hurt the team performance. If Shani Davis had been skating in a new event called the Team Pursuit, I have little doubt that the Americans would be sitting on a medal. I don't know what color, but they'd certainly have that medal. But the fact is, speed skating is an individual event, and you're trying to layer a team approach onto an event and a psychology that has always been individually oriented. And you know, if I'm Shani Davis and then they come to me a week beforehand and say, we want you to skate in this thing, I'd be like, well, why? You know, it's an individual thing. And if they said, well, we want Chad Hedrick to win a medal, I'd be like, well, so? I mean, I think everyone's, you know, got a viewpoint here. And I will say this. Shani Davis saved himself for the 1,000 meters. He skated in the 5,000 last Saturday. Said after that he was not going to skate in this team event, which was held in the middle of the week last week, and was going to save himself for the 1,000. That was a mandatory gold medal for him. He had to do it, and he came through, and kudos to him.
And the pressure on him, who has now become the first black athlete to win an individual Winter Olympics gold, must have been terrific.
Of course it was terrific, but that's why we all come to the Olympics, because we're all projecting, in a way, how would we do in this situation? And because most of us can't do the things that these athletes can do, we all want to see what they're capable of. It's great theater, and it's great fun to watch.
Talking with Alan Abrahamson, Los Angeles Times Olympics reporter, also working for NBC. Well, with all of this stuff going on, and, of course, we saw these dramatic falls last night, probably the sort of thing that some viewers, and particularly those who are not attuned to sports, are looking for, why have the ratings not been better?
I wish I knew, and I assure you that I'm you know, working in a minor capacity for the network.
Not going to blame you for the ratings.
No, only in my own house. I don't know. I mean, I think there are tremendous changes afoot that are affecting the broadcast and newspaper industries, and everyone's trying to figure them out, honestly.
What about the fact that so many athletes aren't participating, in the case of Michelle Kwan, certainly a big draw for a lot of people who aren't normally students of the games, and other athletes who were expected to do well who weren't?
Well, let me ask you a question. If you were Bodie Miller's sponsors and he'd so far gone 0-for-4, how would you feel about, you know, investing all that money in him so far, and the pre-games hype in Bodie, which was audacious, to say the least? It is true that Americans, not just through NBC, but in the newspapers and everywhere, Americans are used to storylines. I would say that the storylines that those of us who came here expecting to write have turned out very differently. If you could have won a big bar bet before last week asking who Ted Ligety was, and well, you might still be able to win that bar bet, but everyone knew who Bodie Miller was for sure.
Well, do you think it's going to get better in terms of audience interest in the days remaining?
Well, this week is the ladies' figure skating. So I would say that ladies' figure skating, no matter who, no matter what, no matter where, no matter when, is always a big draw. All so, right. Yeah, I would expect things to be better.
All right. Well, good luck to you in Turin and to all the athletes as well. Alan Abrahamson, always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Warren.
Olympics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Today's program produced by Jonah King with Sherman Rembaum and Cameron Redzinner, technical director John Patrick Costello. You can listen anytime on moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.